Well, thanks. I'm Jordan Bell. I'm with Texas A&M AgriLife, Research and Extension located at Amarillo. And do want to point out that today I'm only presenting data from 2016. Our 2015 corn crop was hailed out, and we have not harvested 2017 yet. So I have 2016 data to present. And, of course, I also do want to recognize our collaborators. And what is unique about this project is that we are actually looking at a response across the western portions of Kansas down through the Texas High Plains. And in all of these western regions of the Great Plains, we are faced with very similar issues. We are all in portions of the southern Oglala Aquifer where we're facing water issues. And we're also in a very low precipitation zone, looking at an annual precipitation of about 460 millimeters. And so that can be variable. So we're faced with very similar challenges. Although what is unique is that we do have a different potential ET throughout the region from south to north. So of course, the Oglala Aquifer, this is actually a large aquifer in the central U.S. It underlies 80% of the U.S. high plains, actually portions of eight states. And it does represent about 32% of the groundwater use and about 10% of the U.S. crop sales, so it's very significant. It is an unconfined aquifer, so when we talk about the hydrogeology of aquifers, an unconfined aquifer generally has very good quality water. So we do have good quality water. However, the saturated thickness of this aquifer does significantly decrease from north to south, from Nebraska down into the Texas High Plains, and from 30 meters in the north to about 300 meters in the north of Nebraska down to 30 meters down in Texas. And then, of course, with that, the depth to water increasing as we move north to south. So, of course, when we talk about this and the reason why we do have a significant problem with irrigation water in Nebraska, moving south from Nebraska, is that we do have very little recharge. In Texas and Kansas, we've actually lost about 50% of our saturated thickness since the early 1950s. And you can see actually looking at this this map here, because of the shallow depth of the aquifer as well as the soils in Nebraska, they do have a recharge of anywhere from 100 to 200 millimeters per year. However, as we move south and into the Texas High Plains, that recharge is very negligible, usually less than 10 millimeters per year. So our rate of extraction is significantly more than that rate of recharge. And so with that, we have considerable decline in our irrigation well capacity. And so because we are in a semi-arid region, because we do have negligible in-season precipitation, we are definitely dependent on irrigation to stabilize crop production in most years. So with that, just to give you a little bit of background on high plains corn management, producers are beginning to irrigate their circles with a well capacity that's insufficient in most years. And looking at historical data, we can see that Kansas producers can produce more with less water, and that is due to a lower potential evapotranspiration in comparison to Texas producers. And this is actually very evident looking at the slopes of this data plotted, as well as the intercept right there on that x-axis. We can see looking at historical data from Texas, looking at data from the USDA ARS experiment station in Bushland, that our intercept is closer to 300 millimeters in comparison to Texas. And so really that is that point where we are transitioning from that vegetative production into reproductive development, actually seeing grain yield. Whereas in Texas, in Kansas, it's significantly less. And also just looking at the risk. This is actually a plot that Robert Schwartz, USDA, he simulated. And looking at the decrease in precipitation, I don't know if I can get the cursor to work. Well, maybe I better not point. But So looking at this, going from 300 millimeters of precipitation to about 250 millimeters precipitation, we can see that our total production significantly declines as we plant more acreage just due to the risk associated with that variable precipitation. And that's looking at actually a well capacity of about 439 gallons per minute. So we can see that due to low in-season precipitation, planting greater acreage really does increase that risk. So it's really important that producers really do consider their well capacity and the yield of that well when they determine their pre-season irrigated acreage. So with that, our challenges in this region are complicated by extremely variable irrigation requirements during the peak ET period. In an average year, we can see that during that peak period from about V12 to R1, we're looking at about 7 millimeters per day irrigation requirement. However, during an extreme year, 2011 specifically, we had an irrigation requirement of 14 millimeters per day. And so, of course, what does that really mean? So to achieve that water requirement, or to meet that water requirement of 7 millimeters per day, we're looking at a well capacity of 6 gallons per minute per acre. So with that, on our average irrigated circles, which are about 120 acres, that's about a 700 gallon per minute well. And most producers no longer have that well capacity. If they do even achieve well capacities closer to 400 to 500 gallons per minute per acre, they're actually tying together multiple wells. So in most areas, producers are not able to meet that peak ET demand with well capacity. With that, we see many producers who do pre-irrigate, which is usually the least efficient form of irrigation. But due to our soils, they're able to store that water because we do have very good water storage capability in our soils. And that water storage is actually what helps producers meet that peak ET demand, which because this is actually during one of our drier periods of the irrigation season. So with that, Southern Great Plains challenges. We have regionally declining well capacities, we have high and seasonally variable crop water demands, and producers do need information on how to manage that limited water during those peak demand periods. And so specifically, how are we going to help producers improve pre-plant decisions to enhance water use during the season? And of course, one of the questions that producers do have is drought-tolerant hybrids. And it's really important. I'm excited to hear the presentation later today that does address drought-tolerant hybrids, because we have seen that while temporally we have temporally variable water patterns throughout the season, that total seasonal water use in this region really does not change with those drought-tolerant hybrids. And then, of course, also populations. Generally, on those lower well capacities, producers do plant the lower populations. However, this can be a catch-22 because that canopy does moderate the microclimate in these fields. So the objectives of this study, first of all, was to quantify hybrid and population responses to irrigation well capacities for three hybrids in Texas and western Kansas. And of course, Dr. Schlegel will be talking about the data in western Kansas. And the data that I am presenting today deals with our first objective as well as a little bit from our second objective. The second objective was also to normalize the yield production functions across the regions according to the vapor pressure deficit differences. And then thirdly, after we do have the data compiled, there will be an evaluation of the economics of corn production for the various well capacities, hybrids, and plant populations in these sites. So this data, the research plots were at the USDA ARS laboratory at Bushland, Texas. Plots were under a lateral move sprinkler. We evaluated three hybrids. We had two drought-tolerant hybrids, DeKalb 6227 and Pioneer 1151, and then we had a non-drought-tolerant hybrid, DeKalb 6298. We planted at two populations, 64,000 and 99,000 plants per hectare, and we had two different irrigation rates. 28 and 59 liters per hectare, which is equivalent to 3.1 and 6.3 gallons per minute per acre. And as I mentioned earlier, this 3.1, this actually only supplies, when we look at that peak water demand during this period, we need on an average year 7 millimeters per day to meet that demand during V12 to R1. And so 3.1 actually would only supply half of that. So we would need, you know, a greater well capacity to meet that demand for that. So looking at our 2016 growing season, we actually did have some very nice environmental stress from V12 to R1. Now, of course, for our producers, they never want to see that, but fortunately for our study we did, we can see that those daily temperatures during this region for a period, we approached 40 degrees Celsius, and we did exceed that for several days. So we had some very nice stress during that period. But we also had very negligible precipitation until August. Temperatures did cool off during August during grain fill, and we had above average precipitation in late August and early September during that year. Now, those the water use efficiencies did decrease due to that precipitation late in the season, but nevertheless, we had very good stress at pollination. So looking at our grain yield, we did not actually see any significant differences at the higher irrigation rate, which, of course, as to be expected, that higher irrigation rate did yield the best. At both populations, we have here 64,000 seeds per acre. We have 89,000 seeds per acre at that high irrigation rate, and there was no significant difference between hybrid or between population at that high irrigation rate. However, at our lower irrigation rate, we did see some differences between hybrids. What was interesting to me is that we have this non-drought tolerant hybrid that numerically did yield better. So that does, you know, raise some questions about the performance of those drought tolerant hybrids. And of course, with that crop water use, we did not have a hybrid or population effect. There was not any soil water that was extracted at deeper depths by all the hybrids at the lower irrigation rate. This is actually some data from just the 1151 looking at the low irrigation rate and the high irrigation rate. And I do think that this was in large portion a function of, we also had high in-season precipitation in May. So we did plant on very high or good soil water. We had deep water when we planted, so there was no need for those roots to root down. We didn't see any really deep extraction between the two treatments. However, we did see a significant effect between the treatments, the irrigation treatments. Of course, our in-season precipitation was about 250 millimeters, and our irrigation for our high irrigation, this is that 6.3 gallon per minute per acre well capacity, we had 530 millimeters, the lower 330, so we had a difference in about 200 millimeters in irrigation. Now, this is actually just some data from one of the hybrids, but there's a few things to point out with this. Of course, when we look at, as you saw, there was not any yield difference between the two populations at that higher irrigation rate. Of course, at that lower population, we do see we have fewer ears. We do see at that higher population, those ears were smaller. However, with that, the increase in the number of ears did compensate for that ear size. And so one of the things, of course, when we get down to the low irrigation rate, this is where it's really critical. This is where it's really critical for producers to consider that population where they have limited well capacities, because we can significantly see how a high population at a low well capacity significantly affects that. Another thing that was really critical in our trial last year, we saw a significant amount of ear rot. And a lot of this was at the higher rate. We saw greater stress, and we saw significantly more ear rots at those higher populations, and that was significant. Now, of course, how does this translate to biomass? At the higher rates, we did not have any significant difference in biomass. However, at that lower irrigation rate, both populations, we did see significantly lower biomass production. And of course, translating that to the harvest index, we see that, again, at that higher irrigation rate, there was really no significant difference in harvest index. However, at that lower irrigation rate, we really saw where that harvest index dropped. So, of course, what does that mean? When we consider the value of that biomass and those photosynthates, you know, actually converting to grain production, that's pretty significant. So looking at this, actually looking at that crop coefficient, and any number greater than one signifies there was not any crop water stress. When we're looking at, of course, that potential ET versus the actual crop water use. Under our high irrigation rate, there was no stress. However, at that low irrigation, we saw stress throughout the entire season. So with that, though, considering the vapor pressure deficit, I did mention that that was a key objective of this study. Looking at the difference between the irrigation rates as well as the population, we really see a significant difference with those vapor pressure deficits. So at that low vapor pressure, or at the low rate, we saw, of course, we'd have increased stomatal closure, and of course that would result in decreased carbon assimilation and decreased yield and harvest index. So we really saw how having that low irrigation rate for both populations resulted in increased vapor pressure deficit and really increased stress in that canopy. So that's where there really can be a catch-22 with adjusting that population, because we are modifying that microenvironment. So in conclusion, water use is totally dependent on irrigation rate, not necessarily the plant population or the cultivar. That's really what we saw with this. So it's really, really important as producers are considering the planted acreage they plant to really consider that well capacity going into that. Drought-tolerant hybrids may use water more efficiently, but it's really going to be important that we look at our 2017 data to see that. And of course, what was key in this, 82% of our yield reduction could be explained by that biomass and the reduction in biomass production. And then finally, interactions between population irrigation rate with respect to grain yield and the lowest irrigation rate, lower populations had the greatest reduction. So with that, we appreciate our sponsor, the Little Aquifer Program, and about a minute for questions. Right on.
If you've got questions, you'll be around, and we can.